Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Live on air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
That would be me. Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company for another edition of the Irish programme Live on Era. I'm with you until 7. Before I do anything, can I say a big thank you to Dave Hodgson for looking after you with the Daily since 4 o'clock. Thanks, Dave. Safe home and have yourself a very pleasant evening. Hopefully there'll be something to shorten the road on the programme for Dave and indeed for you as well. If you happen to be on the road or relaxing at home or maybe listening at work, wherever it is that you are, I hope that you've had a good week and looking forward to another hour of some good Irish music, some entertaining conversation and other bits and pieces in there as well. In fact, I'll tell you what we have for you. Regina Whelan Richardson will be joining me to talk to me about the Salamanca Archive, a hugely important connection and a link between Ireland and Spain that has existed for centuries. More details on that a little later on in the programme. We'll have our famous Irish birthdays as per usual, some news from home and some wonderful music, some of that drawn from our birthday file. But I will also be playing the number one song in Ireland on this very day, the 5th of October back in 2004. As always, if you would like to get in contact with the programme for any reason, to comment on something that you've heard, to ask a question, or maybe to let me know about something that is happening that we might be able to promote for you. You'd never know if it happens to be where I am, where we might be able to attend and give some additional coverage of it. So let me know, please. You can contact me, as always, at ger@tre.radio. That is the email address for the programme. All right, ger@tre.radio. I think we will start with the birthdays, as we normally do, ease ourselves into the programme, it being a Monday. And as I said, I hope you had a good week so far since I spoke to you last. Bob Geldof celebrates his birthday today. Yes, indeed. He from the Boomtown Rats and Live Aid and all sorts of things. A singer and humanitarian, I suppose you could call him, born in Dublin on this day back in 1951. Brian O'Nolan, also known as Flann O'Brien or Miles Nagopoline, the writer, was born in Strabane on this day in 1911, and a wonderful singer, unfortunately no longer with us. Frank Patterson was born in Clonmel in County Tipperary on this day back in 1938. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the 6th of October, Gerry Adams, the former Sinn Féin president, born in Belfast in 1948, a man that jointly with so many others put together the Good Friday Agreement. Niall Quinn, the wonderful footballer and football administrator, born in Dublin on that day in 1966. And Ernest Walton, the physicist, he was the first person to split the atom. Yeah, he was also a Nobel laureate. He was born on the 6th of October in 1903. Wednesday is the 7th, and Cian Healy, Leinster and Irish rugby player, born in Dublin on that day in 1987. Micheál O'Donnell, singer, songwriter, musician, closely aligned with the Bothy Band and many others, born in Dublin in 1951. And Thomas Kennelly, the Irish-Australian author of Schindler's List, was born in 1935. Thursday is the 8th. We're whipping through the months, aren't we? Absolutely. Ardal O'Hanlon, actor and comedian, born in Carrickmacross in County Monaghan in 1965. You'll remember Ardal O'Hanlon as Father Dougal in Father Ted. Gavin Friday, the singer-songwriter, born in Dublin in 1959. Tony Ward, former rugby international, and he is now a pundit, born in Dublin in 1954 on that day. And Gareth Knox, violinist, born in Dublin in 1956. Friday is the 9th. Chris O'Dowd, actor and comedian, born in Boyle in County Roscommon in 1979. Nicky Byrne, the singer with Westlife, is now a broadcaster. He was born in Dublin in 1978. And RTE broadcaster Ronan Collins was born in Dublin on that day in 1952. On to the weekend we go. Saturday the 10th of October, Una Healy the singer, she from the Saturdays, she was born in Thurles in County Tipperary back in 1981. And Dickie Rock, the showband singer, still going strong. He was born in Dublin in 1946. Finally, next Sunday is the 11th, and Anne Enright, the writer, was born in Dublin that day in 1962. And Joe Canning, wonderful Galway hurler, born in Portumna in 1988. So we say happy birthday to those still living on our birthday file, and those that are gone, we remember them and mark their birthdays as we like to do on a weekly basis. In fact, Here's a man that is still going strong, I am glad to say, and I mentioned that when I mentioned his birthday. Next Saturday is his birthday, born in 1946. Here's Dickie Rock. There's a man who celebrates his birthday this coming week, next Saturday. In fact, Dickie Rock. He was born in Dublin in 1946, and that's a song that's called Simple Simon. Simple as that. Right, a story that started to emerge last Tuesday back home, but it's still very much to the fore. Dublin City Council is to initiate legal proceedings against a developer called Derry Row after the demolition last week of the home of 1916 leader the O'Rahilly in Balls Bridge. Now, the property was at number 40 Herbert Park, was once belonging to the 1916 leader. It was bulldozed by a company developing the site last Tuesday. Dublin City councillors had recently passed a motion to have the property added to the record of protected structures, which would have prevented its demolition. The council has said that it does not consider that there was a breach on the part of the developer to not endanger a protected structure, and there is an active planning permission for the site. However, the council did say that it had written to Derry Row saying that it believes that a number of conditions attached to the planning permission were not complied with prior to demolition. Last month, Derry Row was granted permission to develop the site despite objections by local residents, Sinn Féin TD Chris Andrews, Dublin City Councillor Micheál McDonagh, the 1916 Relatives Alliance and O'Rahilly's grandson. The council has given instructions to its legal department to initiate legal proceedings under the Building Control Acts 1990 to 2014 for, as it quotes, willfully or recklessly submitting information to the Building Control Authority, which was false or misleading in a material respect. Now, in addition, the council has also issued an enforcement notice on the site after it quoted, building commenced prior to compliance with conditions set out in the planning permission. Now, the building works on the site must stop following this order. It also emerged that the council wrote to Derry Row on the 2nd of September requesting that its conservation section be granted access to the property to examine the structure's special interest following its proposed addition to the RPS. Now, the council planned to carry out a full written assessment and photographic record of the structure, but it was not facilitated despite the council's letter. Speaking in the Dáil last Wednesday, Taoiseach Micheál Martin said, I think given the significance of the O'Rahilly in terms of the War of Independence and his historic significance, to destroy the building is absolutely shocking. The house was built in 1907, and the O'Rahilly, the only 1916 leader to die in battle, was the first occupant of the property. His widow lived there until her death in the late 1960s. That's a story I think that we're going to hear a little bit more about, and it's such a sad story that the property has been destroyed at this stage, and no record of it kept. So we'll see how it proceeds over the next wee while. I am going to take a quick little break right now, come back to me just after that, and I'm going to be talking to Regina Richardson about the Salamanca Archive.
Live on ERA, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Welcome back to the programme. I did tell you I was going to be talking to Regina Richardson about Salamanca, the Salamanca Archive, which can be found at St. Patrick's College in Maynooth. And Regina came to me via our Spanish-Irish cultural advisor, Jose Antonio Sierra, who works diligently for the programme on a regular basis, a weekly basis, or maybe even a daily basis. And Regina joins me on the phone right now. Regina, it's lovely to talk. Sorry, you're actually on Zoom, which is even nicer. Good to talk to you and welcome to the programme.
Hello, and thank you for having me on.
Not at all. Regina, as I said just there, it was Jose Antonio Sierra brought your name to my attention because he and I had spoken, and indeed it has been mentioned on the program before, the great connection between the Spanish and the Irish that goes back centuries. And he did tell me about the Salamanca Archive. He did tell me about the importance of it. So I'm thrilled that we're finally going to be able to find out a little bit more about it and maybe about yourself putting it together. And I know that you and Jose Antonio, I think your paths first crossed when you worked as a librarian and information officer for the Spanish Cultural Institute in Dublin, which Jose Antonio was responsible for setting up. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. I began in 1977, and that's where I first heard of the Salamanca Archive from the director, Jose Antonio.
Yeah.
And after that, I went to pursue a diploma in library and information studies.
Right.
And then I suppose I really became intrigued by it when I was in Salamanca itself.
Okay.
In summer of 1980. At that time, there were two Salamanca scholarships. They were awarded annually by the Irish and Spanish governments. And I was on one of those, which was a summer scholarship. And when I was in Salamanca, I visited the magnificent Colegio Fonseca, mm-hmm. which was the building occupied by the Irish College in Salamanca.
Right.
With its fabulous patio and galleries, now belongs to the University of Salamanca, and it can be visited, and it's a residence also, and sometimes people from outside the university can stay in it as
okay.
well.
And where did your interest in Spanish and Spain and things Spanish come from?
Well, that would have been 10 years prior to being in Salamanca.
Right.
In 1970, I had just finished my leaving certificate. And I was at home one day in summer, not really knowing what I was going to do, when there was a significant phone call from my old English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And she said quite simply, how would you like to spend a year in Spain
wow.
teaching English in a primary school in Barcelona? So I jumped at the chance. I had a little Spanish. Our school, Muckross Park in Donnybrook, didn't teach Spanish. But there was a teacher who had Spanish, and we were told if we gave up our lunch hour twice a week, we could take Spanish.
Oh.
So I loved language and I took up Spanish.
You were a good student then, and you were academic, I would imagine, from a young age.
Well, particularly languages was and is my love. And I was excited about going to Barcelona. I didn't really think I would have an exciting time because I knew I would be staying in the convent.
Right.
But it was still enough for me to want to experience something of Spain. But as it turned out, it was one of the most amazing years of my life. I'm sure they didn't know the half of what we got up to, but they were very lovely. I made lifelong friends there because the college And the convent was the mother convent. So the nuns there were very young, because as soon as they finished their novitiate, they would come there. So as I say, I made lifelong friends there. A nun whose family came from Majorca, and we're still very friendly with that family. And in fact, I got married in the town where my friends were living.
Isn't that incredible? That's lovely. Now, I know that you did a number of things when you came back from Spain until a such time as you went to Maynooth. How did you end up in Maynooth, and how did you end up working with the archive, the Salamanca archive, something that you had stumbled upon or been informed about by José Antonio back in the late 1970s? How did it happen?
Well, I pursued my interest in Spanish studies. So I went to UCD to do a BA in French and Spanish for 3 years, and then another 2 years doing a master's on Catalan author Carlos Rojas, who wrote in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then I went to work in the Spanish Cultural Institute, did the diploma, and I ended up in Maynooth basically because my father sent me a letter that summer. I was in Salamanca with a cutting saying you should apply for this job as an assistant librarian in St. Patrick's College, Maynooth.
Okay.
Now, when I say you should apply, he meant you must apply. So there I was in beautiful Salamanca in the college residence, the sun coming in through the window, beautiful storks flying up to their rooftop nests. And I can tell you, I wasn't that enthusiastic about returning to Ireland and working in a Catholic seminary in the country.
Okay.
So, however, I really had no idea of the long and really exciting journey on which I was about to embark, both in working in librarianship and with the Salamanca archives.
Okay.
So I got the job. And first of all, I worked as a cataloguer, then as the subject librarian for music and modern languages, of which Spanish was one of my responsibilities.
Okay.
And then I was asked to be a Spanish language advisor to a project to repair, list and preserve a collection of letters in the Salamanca archive and to edit the resulting catalogue. Then to write a chapter in a book to commemorate the Maynooth College bicentenary in 1995.
Right.
So that was how I first got my hands on the Salamanca archive, as it were.
And just a very quick question. It's not a flippant question. I don't mean it to be, but I'm curious. You said that you were working as a cataloguer, which meant that you were cataloguing everything that was there. Now, when you're cataloguing something and you're given a certain amount of paperwork and you're told catalog that, do you kind of, take the heading and say, this is what's here and this is what's contained in it? And then do you get immersed and do you get sidetracked and start reading things and end up saying, oh, jeepers, it's 4:30 already and I got stuck into reading? Or is it a much more basic thing than that?
Well, the librarians don't really have time to read the books. However, you get very adept at skimming through books, reading the contents pages, maybe the introduction. Because as well as cataloguing, you could be classifying it as well, that is giving it subject headings and so on. So you need to know a little bit about the subject, and then sometimes you might get an interesting book and make a note, I'll read that later.
Okay.
Or you might have to even go further, especially I would be cataloguing books in different European languages, so I might need to do a little bit of research as well. It's a very meticulous job because the purpose of the cataloguing is to make sure that people can find the book on the catalogue.
All right, let's talk about the Salamanca archive itself then. And the history of this really goes back to maybe the 16th century or maybe even before, when Irish men traveled to places like Spain and France and other places in Europe to be educated. And there was obviously a great connection between Spain and Ireland because both were Catholic countries. And we had an issue in Ireland in that Catholicism wasn't really allowed, let's say, because of the British rule at the time. And so the Spanish were great in opening their arms and saying, well, come to us and we look after you. And a number of Irish Irish colleges were established in Spain, in Salamanca and Santiago de Compostela, in Sevilla, Madrid, and a few other places as well. And these are the colleges that documented the lives and the education of Irish people and others probably as well. And these are the papers that we're talking about that ended up in Salamanca and then ended up in Ireland when the final college in Salamanca closed in the early 1950s. Is that, in a nutshell, what we're talking about?
Yes, it is. You're correct. There's long been many different kinds of connections between Ireland and Spain, commercial, military, political, religious, and various European countries, Belgium, France, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, provided places of support for the education of Irish Catholic seminarists and laymen.
Right.
So the college came about as part of that network of similar Irish colleges on the continent. They educated both clergy and laity, which many people think they were just for the education of priests, but they weren't. Though later they came to have the specific task of educating and training students for the priesthood. And in fact, Donal O'Sullivan Bear had very close connection with the Irish College in Santiago de Compostela, and he was very annoyed when the Jesuits took over the college in 1613, as it had been founded as a general university college and not a seminary. And there are many papers in the archive by O'Sullivan Bear and his supporters, and also the counter-arguments of the Jesuits. He emphasised the importance of a Catholic education in a Catholic country for Irish noblemen who would lead and sustain their followers in their faith. And the official name of the college in Salamanca is El Colegio de San Patricio de Nobles Irlandeses.
The collection of something to do with St. Patrick and the noble St. Patrick.
The College of St. Patrick of Irish Nobles.
Wow.
That's its official title.
So what kind of stuff is in this archive?
Well, there is a fabulous collection of well over 50,000 documents of all kinds. The largest part is the archive of Salamanca itself. Salamanca was the first, and it was founded by Jesuit Thomas White in 1592, and he petitioned Philip II to endow the college. So Salamanca was the first and the last, but after it was founded, other colleges such as Santiago de Compostela, Seville, Madrid, and Alcalá de Henares near Madrid, they came into being. So the archive holds the archives of those other colleges as well. And they were deposited in St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, in 1952, when Salamanca finally closed. So there's just a huge range of papers. For example, there are the rector's reports and private papers. A large part of it is administrative.
Right.
So of administrative accounts, leases of properties owned by the Irish colleges, rents and royalties, because a lot of their income came from lands that they had bought and leased out, and also from bequests. So there are wills, mortgages, title deeds, and there are a few college photographs as well. So really a very, very wide range. And some of the interesting ones are, and the very early ones are the oaths of the students, because when they first came to Salamanca, they had to, we have the papers of admission. So they had to promise obedience and to return to the Irish mission, that is to go back to Ireland and function as priests in Ireland, sometimes and often in secret in the early years. And these papers of admission have information about their birth. So you have their parents' names, for example, where they were born, and sometimes the names of the head schoolmasters, which is very interesting. With regard to their promise to return to the Irish mission, I'm afraid they didn't all return, and they were to get, there was a special payment called a viaticum, which was paid by the Spanish crown to cover their expenses back to Ireland. But some of them scarpered and stayed in Spain, or some went on to study other things, like medicine was very popular. And eventually there was a rule that this viaticum would be given a la orilla del mar, in other words, on the seashore, just as they were about to get on the boat.
Wow. Some of the information that you sent to me last week about the archive, there was a man mentioned by the name of Alexander McCabe. And I had been reading, I think it was around last year, sometime last year, when the elections were being held here in Spain. And I wanted to try and get a handle on, you know, who was who and what was what and what the history of parties were and so on. And I started reading about the Spanish Civil War. And Alexander McCabe came up in that. And he had significant papers, but am I correct in saying that some of his papers were lost in a fire?
I've never heard of them. We lost in a fire, okay. But I know that he destroyed some of the papers.
Oh, that might be what it was.
Yes, because he was very disturbed by the terrible things he saw during the Civil War in Spain. In fact, he said, "I saw too much," and he destroyed some of his papers. You may have been reading Tim Fanning's book on the Spanish Civil War.
I may have.
McCabe, very good. Yeah, a very good description of his Alexander McCabe's. His private papers are in the National Library, but in the Salamanca archive, we also have his rector's reports, which are very revealing also about his time during the Spanish Civil War. And I was doing some, well, I wrote an article on the Irish in Asturias, which is about the summer holidays of the students in the north of Spain. That was a very exciting time for them when the Spanish Civil War broke out.
Indeed.
Because they were living in a village called Pendueles, and the official government at the time was some of the mayor, for example, the communist mayor was friendly with the Irish college, and they played football with the local lads who were then members of the government militia. And in fact, when the students were evacuated, when the Spanish Civil War broke out, they were evacuated on a British destroyer, and they had to be taken out part of the way on a bus flying the Union Jack and the communist flag.
Right.
They
were really,
eventualities with the lads that they played football with were their escorts. And apparently, according to Alexander McCabe's the vice rector who was there at the time, they were very nice to them and waved them off and hoped to see them again. But sadly, some of the people they were friendly with in that town were killed by Franco's forces, including the mayor of the town.
Wow. In relation to the number of colleges that were in existence a number of hundred years ago, as opposed to Salamanca being the final one, the first and final, as you said, closed in 1952, was that just a process of men were staying at home in Ireland, they were being educated in the various universities that were starting to appear, were no longer travelling, or was there another reason behind why these Irish colleges closed?
I couldn't tell you exactly why each one closed, but certainly the penal laws through the years, they didn't last right up to the 20th century. And then sometimes they were more severe or being applied more severely than at other times.
Right.
When Salamanca closed, really, one could say it was partly due to Maynooth as well being opened. And in fact, the last students who had to leave when the Civil War broke out, many of them finished their education in Maynooth. So as some of the colleges may have closed because they often had financial difficulties, as I said, they had rents and sometimes the rents weren't paid. And so slowly over the years, they closed, but Salamanca was the strongest one and possibly had the most money because, for example, it got requests from various people through the years, and it had a lot of land around Salamanca as well.
The archive itself, Regina, I presume it's housed in a particular part of St. Patrick's College in Maynooth. Can members of the public walk in and access any of the information or all of the information?
Members of the public or people who wish to research in the archive, they would need to make an appointment. with the college archivist.
Okay.
They would really need to know what they were looking for. You couldn't just really walk in and start.
That's what I was, yeah, that's where do you start? Yeah.
And perhaps you could put up some links on the website.
Sure.
After that, one should really have a look at the online catalogue, which again, I can give you a link for that. There's also various publications which are on a bibliography, including the Salamanca letters, which are in hard copy, so they're not online. Again, all of these can be on the link. So it's you would just need to contact the college archivist and let them know what you wanted to look up, and then they could make an arrangement for you to visit
okay.
the college.
You did say
very little of it is digitized.
Ah.
There is an account book from Alcalá, and that's digitized. There's such a huge amount of material that it will take a long time to digitize it all.
Going back a couple of hundred years, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, how has the paper been preserved and how are these records preserved?
Well, most of the paper is very good quality handmade paper. So the quality of the paper itself, it's rag handmade paper. Most of it is acid free with the quality inks. So that is very well preserved. And then a large collection of letters that I worked on, 6,000 Spanish letters. I should say that most of the material is in Spanish
right.
in the archive. And there are about 700 English letters. When that project that I refer to was done, they were all conserved. That is, they were repaired, they were cleaned, they were placed in acid-free folders to protect them. And then the strong room where the archive is then would be subject to very careful temperature and humidity control as well.
Okay. How did you fare out with the language? Has the Spanish language changed much between, let's say, 1600 and 1970?
No, not hugely.
Okay.
Not hugely. One of the things that was quite difficult was their habit, and I don't think it was just in relation to the Spanish language, of abbreviating words. So there would be very many words. Partly this could have been to save space on letters, for example, because paper was expensive and so was postage. So there would be very, very strange endings to a word. And the abbreviation was more visual, really, than linguistic.
Right. All right.
However, so it would be very difficult to make it out. But however, there are reference works
okay.
which list common abbreviations in older Spanish. So I was able to use that to work yeah. out some of the words.
I know that you are retired now, Regina. How long did you spend working on the Salamanca archive?
Well, at different times. I never worked as an archivist with the archive,
okay.
but I would be working with it, doing various things, such as assisting with the conservation of the letters and compiling the book of the catalogue of the letters. And then when I was researching for the chapter in the book of Maynooth Treasures, I spent a lot of time in the archive trying to find things that would be suitable to give an overview
mm-hmm.
of the archive. And that chapter is available online in the Maynooth Institutional Repository, and it's free to look at, as is the article on the Irish in Asturias. And then, of course, one gets a certain familiarity through working so much with the archives. So I would sometimes take queries in the library from people
okay.
who wanted to know about certain parts of the archive. But it was very, I mean, from a personal point of view, there were so many interesting things in the archive as well. Various controversies that broke out in the colleges and personal matters as well. I can tell you about some of those briefly if you would like.
Sure. Yeah. I'm conscious, Regina, of your time more so than my time, because we did say that we'd be chatting for about 15 minutes and I know we've gone over that. So please give us an example of that. That'd be lovely.
Some of the controversies that one finds running through the archives are, as I mentioned, the controversy with O'Sullivan Bear and the Jesuits taking over the college in Santiago. But there was also controversy relating to favouritism and the number of places being given to Leinster and Munster versus Connacht and Ulster. So this related to a big Irish controversy between what were called the Old Irish and the Anglo-Irish Catholics, who were seen as being towns, living in towns loyal to the crown, and Catholics from the Pale.
Right.
So that was one big controversy. And then in Alcalá, that was founded for students of the Diocese of Ulster. And when it was to be merged with Salamanca by order of Carlos II, the rector and a student barricaded the door, and the mayor and the police. And I quote, "After formally demanding unconditional surrender from the two valiant defenders of the fortress against all the power of the great king of all the Spains, they had to break open the door and take the college by storm."
Students were at it even back then.
They were. But there are very many. I love when I find personal things in the archive, because there's so much administrative material. Which is very interesting. For example, there's a day book. There are many account books, and there's a day book of gentlemen's accounts, 1876 to 75. And some of the entries for the students, what they owe in these account books, are for the seminary lottery, stamps, paper and envelopes, tips to the servants, cigarros, and then they would go, there was the entry spree, which cost one student 3 reales. So that seemed to be an outing rather than going out carousing, because they were under very strict discipline.
Wow.
And of course, in the accounts, there's all the food that was bought for the college. They ate quite well, as Alexander McCabe called it, Irish food with the good things of Spain.
Lovely.
And then in the letters, some lovely personal things. For example, the rector, James Gartland, who was rector from 1830 to 1866. There are many letters from his nieces back in Ireland. One from his niece Alicia, and she signs herself with her pet name, Missy, the Missy, La Missy, and sometimes writes in French, so giving him family and local news. And then her sister Lily writes to her dear uncle, saying, "Although I am but a little child, I knew you would be pleased if I wrote a letter."
Lovely.
Ella talks about practicing her songs to sing for him, and she's looking forward to him coming home.
Ah, that's nice. It must be lovely to get all those personal little snippets in the middle of all the administrative stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, as I said, I was conscious of the time, and you and I did say we'd have a chat for about 15 minutes, but it's gone way beyond that. Can I say thank you very much, Regina, for talking to us. What was your title when you were working at St. Patrick's in Maynooth?
I did many things.
Right.
Probably subject librarian for music and modern languages.
Excellent. All right. Well, to give you...
And I usually use my full name, Regina Whelan Richardson, for any official... Kind of.
Oh, I have you. So if anybody's looking for information on you, it's Regina Whelan Richardson.
Whelan Richardson.
All right.
Yeah, and then so subject librarian for music and modern languages. Although there are two colleges, St. Patrick's and Maynooth University, the library serves both colleges. So officially, I would be employed by Maynooth University.
Okay, I have
as it's now called.
Sorry?
It's been fantastic to be able to speak about the Salamanca archive, and to let people know about it. And if you could put some links up on the website, then people who are interested could pursue it further and read about all the various aspects of the archive.
Absolutely. If you send those links to me, I will certainly do that. And I will put them up on Twitter as well, and share them for as many people that want them. And anybody that's listening that can't find them, if you get in touch with me at jer@tre.radio, I will certainly pass them on to you in person. All right. Regina, thanks ever so much. Regina Whelan Richardson, the former subject librarian for music and modern languages, literatures and cultures at Maynooth College. Thank you so much for telling us about the Salamanca Archive, which is based at St. Patrick's in Maynooth. And we look forward to finding out more about it at another date in the future.
Thank you very much.
There's a tear in your eye, a And I'm wondering why, for it never should be there at all. With such power in your smile, sure a stone you'd beguile, and there's never a teardrop should fall. When your sweet lilting laughter's like some fairy song, and your eyes twinkle bright as can be, you should laugh all the while, and all other times smile, so now smile a smile for me. When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morning spring. In the lilt of Irish laughter, you can hear the angels sing. When Irish hearts are happy, all the world seems bright and gay. And when Irish eyes are smiling, sure they'll steal your heart away. When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morning spring. In the lilt of Irish laughter, you can hear the angels sing. When Irish hearts are happy, all the world seems bright and gay. And when Irish eyes are smiling, sure they'll steal you.
That's a lovely song. It comes from Frank Patterson, unfortunately no longer with us. And Frank would have been celebrating his birthday today, born on this day in 1938 in Clonmel in County Tipperary. And thank you to Regina for a lovely chat, and apologies again for keeping her so long. But it was hugely interesting, the Salamanca archive information. So I hope that you got something from that. And a little later on, I will be putting up the information that Regina sends to me in relation to the links that you can follow if you would like to go there. So I will put that up. I will tweet it out. But next week on the programme as well, I will give it a mention just to be sure. Alrighty, let's do a quick break, shall we? Come back to me just after that. I've got lots more to tell you. And we have the number one song in Ireland on this very day back in 2004 to play, among others.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Welcome back to the final part of the programme. And number one song is usually what we take in Ireland on a particular date. Back in history, obviously. And we're going back 16 years. Hard to believe that when we talk about 2004, it's 16 years ago. This song was number one on this day, the 5th of October, way back then, from Mr. Brian McFadden.
Showbiz dinners and the free champagne. Men in suits who think they know it all. No one knows me, but they know my name. That's not real to me. Hotel lobby to the aeroplane. Another country, but they start to
when I see my babies run,
the first day of the summer, and I lays here all the day. And we'll invite the family round and drink some English tea. Then I raise up my finger and watch football on TV.
Song in Ireland on this day in 2004, Brian McFadden. That's a song that is called Real To Me. Hope you enjoyed that. Now, a government scheme in Ireland aimed at supporting the hospitality industry, which has been so negatively affected by COVID-19, launched last Thursday, the 1st of October. And indeed, it's not just Ireland, but other countries as well. The UK would be in dire straits in the hospitality sector, as would a lot of Spain at the moment. Anyway, the Stay and Spend scheme in Ireland allows taxpayers to claim a maximum of €125 back in tax credits on their spending in the hospitality sector up to next April, the 30th of April, in fact, next year. To qualify for the maximum amount, a person must spend up to €625, or in the case of married couples or civil partners, €1,250 in restaurants, pubs, hotels, B&Bs and other qualifying businesses. People can claim the relief on the cost of accommodation and food, including soft drinks, but not including alcohol. But they must also have an income tax or a universal, this universal service charge that we pay. Yeah, must have one of those liabilities against which the tax credit can be set. Taxpayers can upload their receipts for qualifying expenditure through the Revenue Receipts Tracker app to avail of the tax relief. You'll have to take a photograph of your receipt and upload it onto the app. You can continue to submit receipts until the €625 cap is reached. I wonder, can you just submit it at the end of the year if you're self-employed? Must check that out. According to Revenue, the credit will then be offset against your income tax liability and will be applied after all other allowances, deductions or reliefs have been taken into consideration. While €125 or €250 for a married couple or civil partner is the maximum that can be claimed, a 20% refund can be claimed on any spend in a restaurant or hotel as long as it costs at least €25. The scheme will only apply to hospitality businesses that have registered for the scheme, and the government is encouraging those who've not signed up to do it if they haven't done so as yet. The government stressed that it hopes that the scheme will support businesses affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, but was aware some areas are currently facing stricter restrictions to limit the spread of the disease. So there we go. I suppose it's going to be difficult for people to do that in places like Donegal and Dublin at the minute. But fingers crossed that'll all be resolved very, very shortly. Well, that's it. That's my lot for the programme. I hope that you have enjoyed what I've put together and presented to you. I certainly enjoyed putting it together and presenting it. As always, can I remind you that the contact details for the programme, ger@tre.radio, is the email address. Can I say thank you to my guest today, Regina Whelan-Richardson, talking to me about the Salamanca Archive. Thank you to our Spanish-Irish Cultural Associate or Assistant, that is Jose Antonio Sierra. And Jose Antonio works diligently on the programme and finding wonderful guests like Regina. So thanks to Jose Antonio. Most especially, can I say thank you for listening, and I hope that you will join me again next Monday for another edition of Live on Era. In the meantime, have a great week, look after yourselves and each other, and I'm going to leave you with this particular song. It comes from Gavin Friday, another man on our birthday file. He celebrates his birthday this coming week as well. In fact, it is on Thursday, the 8th of October. He was born on that day in 1959 in Dublin. Here's a lovely song. It's called Angel, to take us out. From me, Ger Sweeney, until next week, bye-bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.